One of the dangers is the more we practice, the longer we practice, we gain more knowledge, more experience, we might gain more skill in meditation, we get some samadhi and peace. If we've never developed this sense of respect and deference for the teacher and for the vinaya, as we gain the knowledge and the peace, we get more self-confident. As we get self-confident, we just believe ourselves and we're not going to listen to anyone else, not take much interest in other people anymore. We just be sure of ourselves, our own views, our own experience, and that can lead to a problem if one's actually supporting the ego and all the kalesas that go with that. Whereas one, if one's established in this sense of respect for Dhamma Vinaya, you know, it's something higher than one's own views, one's own preferences. One establish that from the beginning, then it's a protection from this arising of over self-confidence and being one who just doesn't listen to anyone else. So it's very important to establish oneself in the beginning in that respect for the teacher, respect for Dhamma Vinaya, and that will protect you from your practice. The Buddha respects the Dhamma. He didn't say anything as on the level of self, ego, preferences. Is always the Dhamma is the highest. But even the Buddha has the Dhamma as the highest. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In Melbourne today, there are a lot of meditation classes. But in my office, there are people just go to meditation. Because there was my peace, my calm, and meditation, and then, like you said, I'm afraid that I don't know what will happen to them when they meditation are too strong, you know, good support of
the danger of not having a teacher or a system of training, Dhamma Vinaya. So, as one meets with different experiences in the course of one's meditation development, one won't have any reference point, one won't have any way of really judging or gauging how to deal with it skillfully. So, say, one might have visions arise, one might attach to that something good or even the best. The sense of self arises around that. There's no letting go of self, it's just actually, you know, creating a more of a sense of self based around the results or the experiences of the practice. Very easy to get deluded, lost, because there's no teacher or there's no system. Dhamma Vinaya is a whole system of training. So, that's, again, it's a protection against that. If one has a teacher, one can go and consult the teacher, or people more experienced who one respects, one goes to them, one will be giving up this sort of sense of self that will form around the experiences and practice. One will listen, one will get advice, will know how to treat them well to help them let go. The result of practice and letting go, not doing that, you go out of one practice and let go of what you want. That's a piece of mind.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. The question was, what do we do if the teacher is teaching us wrongly? Then we have to have wisdom. We still have to be able to contemplate the teachings you receive. If you're in doubt, you can get a second opinion, compare with other teachers, or you said, well, go back to the Buddha and go back to Lumpur Cha, who are our sort of, Lumpur Cha is the modern founder of our tradition. The Buddha also sees what his teacher is teaching, is it the Eightfold Noble Path, is it fall within that, and the Four Noble Truths, and then, you know, see, does it follow what Lumpur Cha said? We don't have to doubt about Lumpur Cha. Many of us have lived and trained with him. We respect him as an Arahant. His bones have turned to relics. We can go and see them in the teddy. His hair has become relics. Even his excrement became relics. So, you know, we have no doubt he was an enlightened teacher. So what he taught is a very good comparison to anyone else's teaching. And you compare what they say to what Lumpur Cha said, and it doesn't match the difference. Well, that's a sign perhaps that they are our teaching. Says in practice you have to find the right balance or the right amount or the right level. meaning you don't want to be going ahead of your teachers or stepping over them or being too high or too big in front of your teachers or in comparison to your teachers. You also don't want to be too low, aiming too low or thinking of yourself too low, because that can be an obstacle. So I gave the example of a stick. Well, you don't want a stick that's too long. I didn't hear it, but it could be like, say, if you're getting a piece of fruit off a tree, a stick is too long, you can't reach it. It's too short, you can't reach it. You've got to get the right length stick. Something like that. You have to find the right balance.
Didn't the Buddha say that
the
stick is not a big problem, it's not a big deal. But if a wrong view teaching, that is a really big problem.
Yeah. You're just saying matters of vinaya like this are dealt with in this way. There's a process, a system where monks or monasteries are deviating from the norm of vinaya they're dealt with. Or if they're deviating from right view in their teaching, matters of dhamma, wrong views are being taught in practice. That also, there's a process for dealing with that. Over the years there have been times when monks have issues have come up, and the same as a whole have had to deal with teachings, wrong views and so on as well.
Could Ajahn Anand give you advice about how, what kind of practice should go to handle the sensual desire and sensual seeking, that sort of thing?
Lots of contemplation of the body and practice of mindfulness of the body, particularly mindfulness of all the body, not just the superficial look of internal organs, body parts, aspects of the body, and the pleasure we seek in the body, contemplating the 32 parts of the body and the asupa, the unattractive side of the body, countering that pleasure seeking from the desire for bodily contact with sight, sound, taste. So he gave, for example, when you go to the toilet, before you flush, look at your poo, your excrement, and you ask yourself, is that beautiful, is that attractive, is that delightful, something to delight in? That kind of reflection, just done regularly with mindfulness, those kind of reflections. I'm very good at countering sensuality and all the kind of sex desires we have.
What about like sensual stimulation, like vision, hearing, like music?
Different aspects. One, for example, sight. Just contemplate the unattractive aspect of that sight. If you see a sight that's pleasurable, you tend to focus on the pleasurable aspect of what you see. Bring up any unpleasurable aspect of it. Recollect that, focus on that in your mind if there's some unpleasant aspect, just to counter the seeking of pleasure. If it's sound, you're seeking pleasure from hearing music, for instance, contemplate the impermanence of that pleasure. You have pleasure as long as you're hearing that music and the conditions are right, you're enjoying that music while you get pleasure. As soon as the music stops, or even the conditions change while you're hearing it, well, the pleasure stops as well, the pleasure disappears. Contemplate that, the impermanence of pleasure, pleasurable feelings. Contemplate the uncertainty of it all, the whole process of desiring something, trying to get pleasure, can't keep it, can't hold on to it for very long, disappears. Contemplate that with mindfulness, and it leads to a sense of weariness with that pleasure seeking and the uncertainties of pleasure, and the fact it doesn't last very long. You practice and you're seeing the mind get wrenched, you're contemplating, don't do anything other than just watch what's going on. You don't have to contemplate a lot at that time, just observe the whole thing with mindfulness. the feeling of being wrenched or whatever, don't have to add to it or increase that concentration. Just observe the feeling, observe the mind until that experience, that period of experience has changed initially. Then maybe later on you can review it and contemplate again, oh, that's impermanent, that attachment I had for that sight, that sound, it's impermanent. Look at what happened to the heart, felt wrenched at that time, see how impermanent it is, you can review that later. But at the time, just be mindful, you can just gently be mindful of the whole process and don't do anything extra or special, just watch it.
I think an interesting question come up. Let's say you have a sense, desire for something that is not just sexual or the body, but if you let's say music, movies, news, whatever, design, even beautiful nature. If you contemplate the body, does that affect that kind of desire effectively, or is that too oblique to get a good result?
First, you said you can contemplate the body, and it will affect all senses, every form. Because you might contemplate this impermanence, that you've got to die, and then for every sense desire we can follow is impermanent. But then he also said, or you can just contemplate if it's other kind of sense desire like nature or things, just try and find the Dhamma in that sense experience. So he said, if it's, say, you're looking at a waterfall, isn't this beautiful, this nice nature? So we'll try and bring it into your heart, like Dhamma, and say, well, it's beautiful, but it's water, it's always flowing, constantly flowing from high down to low. This company, this movement, this impermanence, this change, never fixed. And just try and find some Dhamma in it, and that will have a sense of detachment.
But the question is, doesn't that lead to this whole proliferation of monks reading newspapers and you know, finding the Dhamma and all these really cool things, which, yes, it happens to some degree, but also it brings in a whole lot of restlessness, and how trustworthy is that kind of, you know, context?
It's more of a Vinaya question, more of a Dhamma question.
No, it really purely as a Dhamma question. Yeah, like how does that affect it? If you tell yourself, you know, I'm reading the newspaper in order to get this enchantment from the world, how well does that work? Like, isn't that a bit of a dangerous game from a Dhammic point of view?
And with these things, it's a matter of strength, particularly wisdom, but mindfulness as well. Strength of one's practice, strength of one's mind. If one has to look at the results, if one does say, look at the news, watch a movie, read a newspaper, or these kind of things, if one's practice is already a bit weak, well, these things will always lead the mind downwards, because one does have enough wisdom, one is drawn into them, lead to more mental proliferation. If there's enough wisdom, one has a lot of wisdom, one can still contemplate these things. Sometimes it's necessary to know a bit about the world, what's going on. But it's a matter of you have to look at the results and be very honest with that. The reason we have precepts is to protect against the mind becoming weaker and weaker by indulging in more things that are just going to distract you and take away mindfulness.
People often say it's good to know a bit about the world. Why is that?
More a matter of one's position. If one is practicing to develop samadhi and wisdom and insight, then these things are not necessary at all. We just said maybe if one is in a position that one, these things maybe can support one, if one has to know a bit about the world, because of one's position, one's worldly position, well, maybe one might have some interest in the news or whatever. If he looks at a paper maybe for about 5 minutes, just gets the important news, like, is it going to rain today?
Even that sometimes not true.
is quite good for health matters, knowing ways to deal with health issues, what health issues are coming up, ways to deal with them, things like that.
In the monks world, people talk a lot about buildings and where people go and things like that. What does India think about that, like just like news or like, you know, also comparison, that monastic kind of chatter? Is that harmless or is it good to build kind of?
The chat about it or the building itself?
Oh, no, I'm sadly young.
So the chat about it?
Yeah, I like the talking. It does take up so much of monastic talking time. It's kind of basically empty chat. And the question is that harmless or is it building the relationship or is it just worse than reading a newspaper?
As long as you maintain mindfulness to talk about such issues as, like, have you finished building your toilet block yet? Then there's no real problem. The thing to do is always maintain mindfulness, not get caught into liking or disliking in this conversation that you might be having about a building project or the state of the monastery or whatever. When he was a young monk, then he used to think like this. When senior monks meet, you think, maybe they'll start talking about some good Dhamma and I'll listen. But they usually talk about fairly mundane things. What are you building in your monastery? How big is the sala? What kind of metal do you use in the reinforced concrete? Things like that. So you think, this is not what I want. I just want pure Dhamma. I just want to practice Dhamma. I don't want to hear about all this. But as he grew in age and responsibility running a monastery, he himself had to start building, so now he's able to talk about it and understand what they're talking about, and he understands the reason and that it is part of our life if you're a senior monk. But you just learn balance in this, it doesn't necessarily have to disturb your meditation. And when the time comes, if people come and ask Dhamma, well, he's quite happy to talk Dhamma and he appreciates that. But you can also talk about building with other senior monks if you meet them, and that's not a big distraction either.